So kia ora, hello and welcome to today's Webber Training Teleclass lecture. My name is Jane Barnett and it gives me great pleasure to once again introduce another of the Webber Training South Pacific series. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker today, very delighted seeing as we had technical issues last week in connecting to him, but he's from Perth in Western Australia, Professor Tom Riley. Tom is currently the Professor in Microbiology and Immunology at the University of Western Australia and also Principal Research Scientist in the Division of Microbiology and Infectious Diseases at the Curie II Medical Centre. He is a member of a number of Microbiology and Infectious Disease Societies internationally, as well as being an editorial board member of the Journal of Antimicrobial Chemotherapy and Australian Infection Control Journal and editor of Reviews in Medical Microbiology. Tom is rapidly becoming a regular in this teleclass series, having already talked to us last year about his work related to tea tree oil. I understand, however, that today's topic is much more of a favourite, and he's become well known for his work on the diagnosis and pathogenesis of Clostridium difficile. Welcome, Tom, and thank you very much for agreeing to come back and speak to us once again on the Webber Training Teleclass series.
Thanks, Jane. It's always nice to talk about my favourite bug. Clostridium difficile. This is a bug I've been working on now for 30 plus years. So it's been a kind of a major part of my life. And as the title of the talk suggests, this is a bug that up until quite recently nobody seemed to care much about. It was always thought of as a bit of a nuisance, a little bit of diarrhea in elderly patients, nothing to worry about. But things have changed quite rapidly, particularly in the last 5 years, or maybe the last 10 years if you include what's been going on in North America. So I'm going to try and give you a very wide-ranging overview, if you like, of all things important about C. difficile, which is a bit difficult to do in 45 minutes. And hopefully you'll see why this organism has gone from relative obscurity to being classified now as a superbug. And I saw an editorial or a paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association last month, which now suggests that C. difficile has surpassed MRSA as the most important nosocomial infection in the United States. So this organism really is important, and hopefully at the end of this session you'll see why. So if we go to the first slide, we'll start with a little bit of background for the non-core, hardcore microbiologist. This is an anaerobic gram-positive bacillus. It belongs to the same genus as tetanus, the gas gangrene group of organisms, botulism, and all those organisms are characterized by their ability to produce lots of exotoxins, and C. difficile is no different. And I would make the point again that C. difficile is now much more important than all those organisms probably put together. It really gained prominence because of a renewed interest in anaerobic bacteriology that occurred in the 1960s and 70s, and I won't go into all the details about that, but just to say that there was this resurgence in interest in anaerobes, and as a result of various laboratories' abilities to start isolating anaerobic bacteria, the pharmaceutical companies then decided, oh, we must have specific anti-anaerobe drugs. And the first one was developed by Upjohn in Michigan in the United States, and that was a drug called clindamycin, which was a derivative of lincomycin. And clindamycin became quite popular in the United States because at that time metronidazole was not available to treat anaerobic infection. So a lot of clindamycin was being used. And soon after that happened in the early 1970s, problems occurred in United States hospitals of patients getting diarrhea following clindamycin use. And this was called, surprisingly, clindamycin-associated diarrhea. What was even of more concern was that some patients went on to get a more fulminant form of disease, pseudomembranous colitis, and whatever was causing this problem seemed to be transmissible because there were outbreaks of pseudomembranous colitis. And you can see there somebody's colon that's been removed. Again, to cut a very long story short, the The cause was elucidated in 1978 when it was shown that C. difficile was responsible for pseudomembranous colitis, proportion of also a group of antibiotic-associated diarrheas that occurred with other antibiotics, and really things started to move forward from there. In 1979, a selective medium was developed by Diane Citron in Los Angeles, and then diagnostic laboratories could isolate C. difficile. But, as the name suggests, this is actually not an easy organism to deal with. It requires a particular selective medium to grow it. A lot of people seem to have trouble growing it, and therefore I think some laboratories have not really been able to diagnose this disease as well as perhaps they should have. So if we go to the next slide, which makes the point that C. difficile is the most common cause of diarrhea in hospitalized patients. I should say right now, though, that there is always has been C. difficile disease in the community. It's not diagnosed as often as perhaps it should be, because it is thought of as a hospital problem. But C. difficile causes disease in the community. The evidence suggests, and I'll come back to this a bit later on, that there is now an increasing incidence and prevalence of C. difficile diarrhea in the community. The organism produces these two major toxins, which are the main virulence factors. So we think toxin A, which is not a classical enterotoxin, but kind of is always thought of as an enterotoxin, and toxin B, which is a cytotoxin. And in 1988, Michel Popoff in France described a third toxin, which is a binary toxin. It was thought of, as not being important in 1988, but as we'll see a little bit later, this binary toxin has assumed greater importance in the last 10 years or so. Now, the production of those toxins, certainly toxin A and toxin B, but not binary toxin, is mediated by this section of the C. difficile chromosome called the pathogenicity locus, or PALOC, and within that little red bit you can see on that green circle, there are genes for toxin A and toxin B, and there are also regulatory genes that control the expression of toxin A and toxin B. And there's one gene which upregulates toxin production, and there's one gene, which is a gene called TCDC, which downregulates toxin production. And again, I'll come back to that because that's important in the story of this epidemic of C. difficile, which is going around the world as we speak. So if we go to the next slide, just to give you an idea, this is how C. difficile and C. difficile toxin was first discovered. So this is a monolayer of Vero cells, African green monkey kidney cells, and these have just been stained with a little bit of crystal violet. That's why they're purple. But you can see this is a nice monolayer and the cells all look quite healthy. If we go to the next slide, you can see how these cells have all rounded up and started coming unstuck from the glass or plastic surface that they're attached to. And this is the typical effect you see with C. difficile cytotoxin, so that's toxin B. And this is what initially gave the hint that some organism was involved, because you can find this toxin in sterile extracts from feces, or you can find it in cultures of C. difficile when you grow the organism. So if we go to the next slide, which talks about risk factors for C. difficile, there are a number of risk factors, but these are probably the most important ones. Clearly, you need to get exposed to the organism, and that's a really crucial point, and I'll labour that in a few minutes when we come back to it. You need to get exposed to something that perturbs the gut flora, the gut microflora, and the thing that does that most often, of course, is antibiotics. And initially, it was clindamycin. Then during the 1980s and most of the 1990s, it was cephalosporins, particularly the extended spectrum cephalosporins. And now, of course, it's the later fluoroquinolones. And these are apparently what's driving this epidemic in North America and Europe at the moment. And the last risk factor, which unfortunately we can't do anything about, is old age. We have an ageing population, and unfortunately it's the elderly that are more susceptible to C. difficile, and that's because the elderly don't mount an antibody response. They don't mount a particularly good response when they see the organism, and so they are more likely to get infected, they're more likely to get recurrences. And those patients that don't produce antibodies at all are the ones that have relapses or recurrences, and you can get anywhere up to 10 or 12 recurrences of this disease. So if we go to the next slide, coming back to the exposure to the organism issue, and what you see here is an electron micrograph of Clostridium difficile. And the little circular bit up in the top right-hand corner is the spore. And this is really crucial because being a Clostridium, it forms spores, and these spores are very resistant to desiccation, they're resistant to heat, they're resistant to disinfectants, and they contaminate the environment, and they can survive for 12 months. So if you get a hospital that's contaminated with C. difficile spores, then patients coming into that hospital who then get exposed to antibiotics are very susceptible to infection. So one of the important infection control messages here is that this is one of those situations where the environment is really, really important. If you remove C. difficile from the environment, then you can use whatever antibiotics you like. The patients won't get disease. But if you've got lots of C. difficile in the environment, then you've got a big problem. So it's that spore, which is the infective particle, and we're probably all ingesting these spores every day. It's just that out in the community there's much less C. difficile, so we're not getting an appropriate dose. C. difficile does not survive in a normal gastrointestinal tract, and so it's only in gastrointestinal tracts that have been upset by antibiotic treatment or cytotoxic drugs or anything else that really perturbs the gut flora. That's when C. difficile can establish. Also, though, C. difficile will get into what I call virginal gastrointestinal tracts. And so young babies, neonates, get colonised by C. difficile. If they're born in a hospital that's got lots of C. difficile contamination in the environment, then these kids will get colonised with C. difficile. Generally, babies don't get infections, though, because the receptors for the toxin are not expressed in the gut at that early stage. The story is different, and I'll come back to this when we start talking a bit about animals later on. But in humans, young humans don't get a lot of C. difficile disease. It's a bit of a mystery, though, and generally speaking in the lab, we don't culture specimens from kids aged 2 years or less because of this sort of dubious role that C. difficile has in those children. So we go to the next slide, and that happens to be a slide of the QE2 Medical Centre, and I'm currently sitting in that building, which is down on the left, lower left-hand corner. And so this is what happens with C. difficile spores. They contaminate the environment of the hospital, and gradually you get a build-up of spores until, I mean, when we sampled this hospital in the 1990s, when we had a bit of a problem, 30% of sites in our extended care ward were contaminated with C. difficile. So if you go to the next slide, you can see some data on C. difficile at Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital, showing that during this period, 83 to 92, when we were using lots of cephalosporins, you can see on the top panel there, the blue line, the rate increasing throughout the 1980s to really the end of the 1980s. Bottom right-hand corner, you can see the increase in use of cephalosporin antibiotics. And in the bottom left-hand, you can see the point again that this is a disease predominantly of the elderly. We do have younger people, of course, but this is a disease which occurs mainly in the elderly population. So if we cut to the current situation with that little bit of background, we became aware that the epidemiology of C. difficile disease was changing when this publication appeared in the Canadian Medical Association Journal in 2004. And it described, and there were a number of papers in this edition of the journal, described an outbreak of C. difficile disease in Quebec province, a part of Quebec province, where they'd noted that there was an increase in the number of emergency colectomies they had to perform because of fulminant C. difficile colitis. And so what they did was they reviewed all their cases from 91 to 2003. They showed that the rate had increased substantially from 35 per 100,000 population to 156. In the elderly, it was even more dramatic, going from 100 to nearly 900 per 100,000 population. The complication rate had gone from 7.1% to 18%. And really significantly, death within 30 days of diagnosis had increased from under 5% to nearly 14% in 2003. So these are really dramatic changes that seem to have occurred. If you go to the next slide, you can see that illustrated graphically. The black line is the overall rate, so this is taken from that paper, and you can see that in 2002, didn't matter whether you were in the younger age groups or the 18 to 64 age group, or the overall rate dramatically increased around about 2002. But in the elderly, which is the green line, this had been going up for some time previous to that, and you'll also note that the scale changes, and so really that elderly line should be much, much, much higher at the end of 2003. So dramatic changes in incidence rates. And to highlight that a little bit more, the next slide just shows the number of cases and number of deaths in Quebec province for the first part of the century. And you'll see, for example, in 2003, Quebec province has a population of around about 7 million. There were 7,000 cases. There were 1,270 deaths, so the death rate was 18%. So that's really dramatic and something we've never seen before with C. difficile. So if you go to the next slide, this is one of the explanations that has been put forward, and it's kind of partly true. So this is a paper published by Michelle Warney in The Lancet in 2005, and what it shows is the amount of toxin being produced, so this is toxin A and toxin B, being produced by the strain that was causing these outbreaks in Canada. And that's the blue line, and these strains are either North American Pulse Field Type 1 or NAP1 or PCR Ribotype 027. And you can see then in blue, for both toxin A and toxin B, compared to control strains, these organisms produce more toxin and they produce it during the log phase of growth, whereas the control strains produce much less toxin and they don't start producing toxin until the organism reaches stationary phase. Now, this is a little bit misleading in as much as this is true for this 027 strain, but it's also true for a whole lot of other strains of C. difficile. And the more we look into this, the more we find that there is a range of abilities to produce toxin by C. difficile. Some strains don't produce a lot of toxin, some strains produce a real lot of toxin, and it's those strains that seem to be able to produce more severe disease. So initially it was just the toxin production which was thought to be the reason for this epidemic in Canada. So if we go to the next slide, which is a little bit busy, but I just want you to concentrate on the first column, which says current BI NAP1 isolates, and the fourth column, which says historic BI NAP1 isolates. And if you look at the historic isolates, you can see that they are mainly resistant to clindamycin, they are all resistant to levofloxacin, but they are all susceptible to gadifloxacin and moxifloxacin. But if you go back to the current isolate, you can see nothing's different in clindamycin, nothing's different in levofloxacin, but the current isolates are resistant to the later fluoroquinolones. So this is probably what's driving this epidemic, in that fluoroquinolones have become very much the antibiotic of the day for respiratory tract infections. In US hospitals, I think they're putting fluoroquinolones in the water these days. And so what has happened is that this strain, which produces more toxin, has mutated to fluoroquinolone resistance. And so what's actually driving the epidemic is the use of fluoroquinolones. So we've selected a nasty strain which has now become antibiotic resistant. So this is a problem of antibiotic resistance more than anything else. So if we go to the next slide, which is some typing data. So this is pulse field gel electrophoresis, which is one of the ways of distinguishing strains. And if you just look at the top half of the gel patterns here, you'll see there's a whole bunch of strains there that are labelled 027, or they're labelled NAP1A or NAP1D. So by pulse field gel electrophoresis, there's one band difference. You can see on the right-hand side, there's the NAP1As have got an extra band, whereas by PCR ribotyping, which is a different sort of typing method, these are all exactly the same. But the interesting thing is that you can take a strain from Canada, one from France, one from the UK, and one from the USA. They're all the same. So this is a clone, or at least some very closely related strains, which have been spreading initially from North America or from Canada into the US, or maybe from the US into Canada. We're not really too sure there. They've then crossed the Atlantic Ocean into the UK, caused some very well publicised outbreaks in UK hospitals, such as the one at the Stoke Mandeville Hospital, and have then gone on and spreading throughout Europe. And that's kind of unusual when you get a single clone doing that. It's a bit like the phage type 8081 Staph aureus that was spreading around the world in the 1960s. So if you go to the next slide, you can just see here, this is an example of how the epidemiology has changed really quickly. So this is some typing data from England and Wales. So this is strains of C. difficile in England and Wales between 1995 and 2003. And if you have a look along the bottom, there are different types of C. difficile by PCR ribotyping, and you can see there's no 027 at all. So this organism doesn't feature in the UK up until 2003. Most of their strains, 55%, are this type 001. So if you go to the next slide, which shows data from 05, 06 and 07, 08, you can see that 001's gone from 55% and then down to 25% in 05, 06. 027 has gone from nowhere up to 26%. And then if you move to 07, 08, you can see that type 027 is now 40% of the isolates of C. difficile in the UK. So this is a really dramatic change in a very short space of time. And that's the thing that I think we really need to be concerned about. This organism clearly has the ability to spread and spread very, very quickly. So if you go to the next slide, you can see how the numbers have changed in the UK over the years in the different age groups. And of course, the elderly age group there, the 60 to 64-year-olds, have got much higher rates than the rest. So up until 2004, you see this trend of everything going up in the UK. If we go to the next slide, which comes from that well-known medical journal, the International Express, this was reported a little over 2 years ago now. It was alleged by the International Express that C. difficile was killing one person per hour in the United Kingdom. And so this led to questions in Parliament, and the British government, or the Health Department in Britain, which had been criticised for many years for their the way MRSA had got out of hand, the government finally decided they should do something about these two major problems, MRSA and C. difficile. And so they started spending a lot of money on improving infection control. And you can see the result on the next slide, which Andrew Pearson kindly gave to me. It's interesting for a number of reasons, this slide. First of all, you can see the seasonality of C. difficile disease. If you just look at the mandatory reporting line, which is the top one, you can see these little peaks that appear. And that's when people getting their winter viral infections and then getting antibiotics probably for no real need. So we have a little peak of C. difficile as a result. But since 2007, there's been this dramatic downturn in the numbers of C. difficile being reported in the UK. And that's a reflection of the amount of money that's been spent on this problem, because this is a very expensive problem to deal with. And the way they've been trying to deal with it is improve antibiotic stewardship, but also trying to clean up the environment. And one of the things I believe has been quite successful in the UK is using vaporized hydrogen peroxide. There's very few things that will kill C. difficile spores. Hypochlorite will do it, but some people don't like the idea of splashing hypochlorite around their hospitals, but it does work. Something that works even better is using hydrogen peroxide vapor, and there's a number of companies now that provide machines that will do this for you. So if you go to the next slide, quick rundown of what's happening in Australia, where we've been spared, and I know this is much the same as the situation in New Zealand. I'm not too sure about anywhere else in the South Pacific. But certainly in Australia, we have strains that produce binary toxin. We have strains that produce more toxin A and toxin B. But as yet there is no widespread fluoroquinolone resistance. So up until quite recently, we had not seen this ribotype 027 strain. Now, that changed last year. We had one case who was a returning traveller, which we worked, was a patient here at in Perth, and she brought back a ribotype 027 from New York. And then in the last 6 weeks, we've had an outbreak, our first outbreak of 027, which has occurred at a private hospital in Melbourne. And that's causing a lot of concern at the moment, because we don't quite know how far it's spread. So clearly we need to do surveillance, and I think everybody needs to do surveillance. Even if it's kind of syndromic surveillance where you're looking for more severe disease that usually accompanies this particular strain, we need to be doing something, but ideally we need to be isolating the organism, typing it, and keeping an eye on what strains are circulating. So what's driving this apparent epidemic? Well, I've already mentioned a couple of these factors. The ageing population, little we can do about that. New fluoroquinolone use is clearly, I think, pushing this problem. And we do need to do something about our antibiotic stewardship and try and reduce the use of this group of antimicrobials. There's been several suggestions that gastric acid suppressants, so proton pump inhibitors and H2 antagonists, that clearly increase the stomach pH, may play a role. They do play a role in susceptibility to other gastrointestinal infections. There have been several papers suggesting that this is also the case for C. difficile. I'm still a little bit dubious, because I'm not sure that C. difficile spores, doesn't matter whether you've got a high pH or a low pH, C. difficile spores will survive. Probably the vegetative form of the bug might survive better with a high pH stomach. And so maybe there is a case to be made that this is all to do with ingesting not just spores, but also vegetative organisms. But I think the jury's still out, and we'll look forward to seeing some more research on this subject in the next few years. The other area that's really become a huge problem is this, the last dot point on this slide, which is the animal reservoir story. So it's been suggested that animals might be acting as a reservoir for human infection. What is the evidence for that? And so I want to spend a little bit of time now talking about C. difficile in animals, because at the moment we've got two what I call parallel problems, one in humans and one in animals. I think there's already good evidence that these two problems have actually merged into one single issue. So is C. difficile, if we go to the next slide, is C. difficile part of a zoonosis? If we go to the next one, you'll see there's a list there of, a very incomplete list I might add, of potential animal reservoirs. C. diff has been isolated from all these animals that are listed on this slide. Some of them, people must have been very brave sampling a Kodiak bear. Others, some of these animals are Australian native animals like quokkas and numbats. But there's domestic animals there like cats and dogs, and production animals like pigs and cattle. And there's probably the production animals, and to a lesser extent the companion animals like dogs and cats, that we need to be concerned about. So if you go to the next slide, you can see here, this is a slide of a number of different animal species and what part of the gut is affected by C. difficile in those animals. And you can see it differs. So up the top we've got humans. This is a disease of the large bowel in humans. Now, the model we use for human disease, which we don't use in Australia because we're not allowed to have hamsters, but in the United States and elsewhere, the hamster is used as a model of human disease. But you'll see with a hamster, it actually causes mainly a cecitis in the hamster. And so really, maybe the hamster is not the best model of human disease, despite the fact we've used the hamster model since 1978 or thereabouts. You'll see that even in some animals, like horses, depending on whether you're a young horse or an adult horse, a different part of the gastrointestinal tract is affected. And last, down on the bottom there, you'll see pigs, and neonatal pigs in particular are very susceptible to C. difficile. So if you go to the next slide, we'll talk about animals. These two animals you can see on the slide happen to be my two cats. And one of the blue Burmese, which is the grey cat, Sushi, she's asleep in my cereal bowl. And you can see quite easily how one could get infectious diseases from one's animals. At about this time, I ran over the other cat, the brown one, whose name is Milo, and I had to go and visit my vet on a few occasions while Milo was being patched up. And so I armed myself with several swabs convinced some animals that I needed to sample them to see if they were carrying C. difficile. And so if you go to the next slide, you'll see our first study, which is published, you know, nearly 20 years ago now, showing that companion animals do carry C. difficile. So in summary, 40% of those animals, it didn't matter whether you were a cat or a dog, at two veterinary clinics carried C. difficile. Very similar to the human situation, the animals that had C. difficile were being given antibiotics. The veterinary clinic that my cats went to had 61% positive versus another one which had 17% positive, and there was a difference in antibiotic policy at those two clinics, which I suspect reflects the different rates in these animals. But on the last line, even more importantly, 62% of environmental sites were positive in these veterinary clinics. So there's gross contamination. And so any animal coming to that clinic is going to get contaminated and ingest C. difficile very, very readily. And this probably happens in some of these big animal production animal facilities, as we'll see in a minute. Interestingly, when we looked at the relationship on the next slide, we looked at the relationship between human strains of C. difficile in this, and animal strains, and in this instance I'm talking about companion animals. So we looked at a bunch of strains from pets and a bunch of strains from humans and strains we got from the environment in veterinary clinics and strains we got from hospitals, and we typed them and we saw a good correlation between the vet clinic isolates and the pets and between the human isolates and the hospital environment. But there was actually no crossover between pets and humans. So let me just make the point. This was 20 years ago. Things have changed dramatically in probably only the last 5 years. So let's go to the next slide, and I'll talk about pigs, and then I'll talk about a few other animals. So this is, on the right, you can see Babe, a well-known Australian pig, sort of. This is a disease which has been described in pigs probably 20 years ago, but in notobiotic pigs, so they didn't have any gut flora. The pig equivalent of Pseudomembranous colitis was described. It really didn't all start happening until about 10 years ago, when all of a sudden in the United States there were these outbreaks of C. difficile disease in neonatal piglets in the US, and had very high mortality, 16% mortality in these piglets. And then since 2000, C. difficile has become the most common cause of enteritis in neonatal piglets in the US, and I would suggest that's probably a worldwide phenomenon now. So the problem in the US, and as we've discovered here in Australia, is that most producers don't know anything about C. difficile. It's not one of your normal pig pathogens, And so they've gone along not knowing what's going on, and now they've got lots of problems with their herds being infected. So if you go to the next slide, you'll see that apart from the mortality, these little piglets, the ones that do survive, by the time they go to market, they're 10% underweight. And so this has significance in terms of economic losses for the pig farmers, because these production facilities for pigs work on very, very low margins. They've already sold the piglets before they're even born. And so they sell them for a particular weight, because the whole process is very well controlled. And if they're down on weight, that costs them money. So big issues in terms of economics in the pig industry. These pigs or piglets, remember the neonatal period in the piglet is only 5 days versus a month for humans, so pigs grow much faster than humans do. These piglets, though, overseas in North America and in Europe, contain one type of C. difficile, and it's ribotype 078. So that's about 80% to 85% of piglet isolates are this particular ribotype. Now, up until 5 years ago, this ribotype was very, very uncommon in humans. And then all of a sudden what we started to see, particularly in Europe, but also in the United States, this pig ribotype suddenly started to appear as a cause of human disease. And I'll go on and talk about that again in a second. We have some data from the US and we have data from the Netherlands, but there's some other countries in the world like Denmark and particularly China. Half the world's pigs actually live in China. And as you'll appreciate, there's a lot of people in China, and that's kind of important when I come back to what I'm going to mention in a few seconds. So we don't have data from these other big pork-producing countries. We started doing some work in Australia. We found several farms here in Western Australia that have got diarrheal problems in their piglets, and they've got C. difficile. We're now sampling pig farms on the East Coast, and we're finding exactly the same thing. So it would appear that there is a problem with pigs in Australia. If we go to the next slide, let's talk briefly about cattle. Cattle get diarrheal illnesses. Neonatal cattle, it's quite common for them to get diarrhea. 10% of neonatal calves or neonatal cattle get diarrhea. Nobody really knows what causes it. C. difficile has been suggested as a cause. In a study that Alex Rodriguez did, published in Emerging Infectious Diseases about 4 years ago, when he looked at 278 cattle, it didn't matter whether they had diarrhea, or calves, I should say, it didn't matter whether they had diarrhea or didn't have diarrhea. He actually isolated more C. difficile from his control calves without diarrhea than he did with his calves with diarrhea. So C. difficile obviously colonizes these animals. Whether or not it causes diarrhea in cattle or calves is a point which needs further investigation. And when he looked at it, it didn't seem to matter whether you sampled, what time you sampled. It did matter what time you sampled, and it did matter in terms of age, but it was unrelated to antibiotic use in these animals, which is completely different to the story in humans and horses, as we'll see in a minute. So if we go to the next slide, which is a bit more information on cattle, again, it shows that some of these human ribotypes, like 017 and 027, can be detected in cattle, but again, mainly in cattle, it's ribotype 078. I guess what really concerned people was another paper published by Alex Rodriguez in 2007, which showed that 20% of retail meat samples from butchers in Canada contain C. difficile. So that's kind of a staggering figure. It's probably a reflection of the slaughtering practices in North America, which are not particularly great. But this caused a lot of concern in the United States and Canada at the time. If you go to the next slide, we're talking about C. difficile in horses. Same sort of issues. It's been described, but it's a problem which is so new that relatively little is known about it. But it appears that in the United States, very expensive racehorses have died. So it's fine if you get a $50 piglet dying. Well, it's not fine because there's an animal health issue there. But from the economic perspective, $50 piglet versus $5 million racehorse. And so this is something the racing industry needs to really take note of. So like the human situation, C. difficile in horses is very commonly associated with antibiotic exposure. And there's a range of antibiotics. The one that's not listed there, which is the one that seems to be causing all the problems now, is a drug, a veterinary drug called Ceftiofur, which is a broad-spectrum cephalosporin. And so what we're seeing here is that the veterinary people are using the same drugs in animals now that we used in humans 20 years ago. And so this is what's promoting the C. difficile problem, and I'll show you some pictures in a minute that kind of confirm that view. So if you go to the next slide, more on C. difficile in horses, you see that adult horses don't often carry C. difficile, much like humans. Adult humans don't. Things that affect the horse gastrointestinal tract, like stress and withholding roughage and changing the volatile fatty acid mixtures in the gut, will make them more susceptible to C. difficile. We have the same issue in foals as we do with calves. Foals less than 2 weeks of age invariably get colonized by C. difficile, and then some get diarrhea and some don't. The mothers of foals that get treated with erythromycin, foals get this Rhodococcus equi pneumonia, and they get given erythromycin to treat that. They get given it orally, and then the mothers come along and lick the foals' faces to get rid of any stuff that's left over. And if they get a little bit of erythromycin, they come down with fulminant C. difficile disease. Now, as the thing from the cattle and pig situation, there's a whole range of different ribotypes found in horses, and it's very similar to the sorts of strains that we find in humans. So if you go to the next slide, you can see this is some data from Vivica Baverud in Sweden, just showing that, again, reiterating the point that normal horses don't seem to carry C. difficile, but if you get horses with colitis and they've been on antibiotics, 42% of those have Clostridium difficile. So this is clearly an antibiotic-associated diarrhea, the same as in humans. So if we go to the next slide, excuse me, I'm just going to have a little drink. So what does this all mean? Well, as I said a minute ago, probably 20 years ago, there wasn't any overlap between animal strains and human strains. But now what we're seeing is a whole bunch of animal strains, all those horse and pig and cattle strains, produce this binary toxin that I mentioned very early on in the piece. Human strains seem to be more binary toxin producers, suggesting that maybe these humans are getting these strains from animals and they're probably getting it from the acquiring it in the community rather than in the hospital. And that's why we're seeing an increase in community C. difficile. If you go to the next slide, you can see that pigs and cattle share ribotype 078. All young animals are getting colonized by C. difficile, and if you give them antibiotics when they're young, it just means their normal flora doesn't establish, and so C. difficile stays there, and it grows, and it multiplies, and it creates a problem. The C. difficile is obviously contaminating meat, particularly in North America, and you can find spores in the meat, but is meat consumption a risk? My view is that it's not a risk, but there's a lot of people debating that at the moment. If you go to the next slide, it's just the last lot of data that's come out about animals. It's a little bit hard to see, but I'll summarise the data in this slide from Glenn Songer, only published last year. Now in the United States, 40% of ground pork, ground beef and ground turkey contains C. difficile. So this organism is spreading widely in the veterinary area. I don't believe it's a problem in terms of eating this stuff, providing it's cooked, but clearly there may be some instances where food might be responsible for the transmission of the organism. So let's go to the next slide, which is the one that really concerns me, and this is a paper published by Ed Kuiper in the Netherlands 2 years ago, where he looks at the emergence of this ribotype 078 in humans. And so what you can see on this slide, he compared ribotype 027 infections with ribotype 078 infections. He showed that 078 infections had increased by 10% from 3% to 13% in that three-year period. In the parts of the Netherlands where 90% of the pig farms were, something's fallen off the end of the slide, but 22% of human infections in that those areas of the Netherlands were now being caused by ribotype 078. The 078 patients were younger, there was much more community acquisition, but significantly the severity and attributable mortality with 078 was the same as 027. So this is another nasty strain. This strain is not fluoroquinolone resistant though. So fluoroquinolones are not driving the spread of ribotype 078. And I'll come back to that in a second. The pig strains and the human strains are genetically indistinguishable. And the most recent data to come out of Europe on the very last line down the bottom of the page, ribotype 78 is now the third most common isolate in Europe. So the question is, why, if you go to the next slide, why is this happening? Well, if you've got a bug which produces spores, which make it very resistant to killing, and then you add antibiotics and antibiotic resistance, then I think you have a potential for a disaster. And I'm really very pessimistic about what's going to happen with C. difficile over the next 10 years. And the reasons for that are on the next couple of slides. So if you go to the next one, I mentioned before that in humans, fluoroquinolone use seems to be driving the epidemic. So what's driving it in animals? You can't get good data on antibiotic usage in animals, but the Danes do actually have some data. So on this slide, and in that little red boxed area there, this is from DanMap. If you want data on antibiotic usage in Denmark, go to DanMap. You can see here, this is the increase in the number of pigs in Denmark between 1990 and 2006. So there's an approximately 50% increase in the number of pigs. So let's go to the next slide, where we're looking at antibiotic consumption in production animals in Denmark. And you can see here that when you talk about penicillins and beta-lactamase susceptible groups or other penicillins and cephalosporins, well, with the former, there's been a 400% increase in penicillins and beta-lactamase sensitive drugs. And in the cephalosporins, there's been 1,000%. So we've got a 50% increase in the number of pigs, and we've got a 1,000% increase in the number and the amount of cephalosporins being used. So where are these drugs being used? If we go to the next slide, again taken from DanMap in 2006, you can see that the consumption of cephalosporins in pigs is given, and the big amounts in the top there that's going up year by year is in sows and piglets. And anecdotally, although nobody ever owns up to this, what we're being told is that the vets are actually giving these piglets an injection of cephalosporin when they're born, allegedly for umbilical stump infection. But you've got to remember that the use of antibiotics in animal feed in Europe has been banned. And so this is a way of getting antibiotics into these animals. So they're saying it's for umbilical stump infection, but in fact it's probably just for growth promoting purposes. So if you go to the next slide, you can see DanMap from 2007 showing again the top line there with the little diamond, systematic treatment of pigs. Again, it's gone up in 2007 to the extent that they actually made a comment, which I've put in there on the left-hand side, saying that the consumption of cephalosporins in pigs is changing from an occasional prescription to more systematic prescription in herds. Now, that to me is really bad. If you go to the next slide, where I'm talking about the population density in various countries in the world. So why is it that what I'm suggesting here is that in the Netherlands, for example, the pigs are in fact a source of C. difficile for humans, and most of this acquisition is in the community. Well, the Netherlands is the 24th most populated country in the world. Population density is 395 people per square kilometre. So it's actually more densely populated than the China is. So we've got people living right next door to pig farms in the Netherlands, and that applies actually to most of Europe. So anywhere you've got lots of people and lots of pigs with this current problem, with all these millions of piglets excreting lots of C. difficile into the environment, not dying, it's just drying out, it's blowing around in the breeze. The average passerby who might or might not be on antibiotics is then ingesting this organism. So China is pretty populated and it has lots of pigs, as I mentioned earlier, so I'd be really worried about China. Why it hasn't taken off so much in the United States, the population density in the US is only 31 per square kilometre. If you have a look at where all the pig farming is done, most of it's in Iowa, which doesn't have too many people. And the same applies in Australia, where our population density is less than 3 per square kilometre. So this problem is not likely to occur in Australia, but in densely populated parts of the world where there are a lot of pigs, I think this is going to be a major issue. So if we go to the next slide, you can see where I've suggested what risk there are from animal exposure. Direct exposure to pigs and horses and cattle, I think, is very important. If you work in a piggery or you work with these animals, then I think you need to really be concerned. Direct exposure to waste and compost, I think, is also a problem. I don't think handling or consumption of contaminated meat is a real issue, and I think that's just a little bit of a red herring, or maybe it's a bit of red meat, although I thought pork's the other white meat. So if you go to the next slide, how can this be fixed? Simple message that we need to start giving everybody. We need to stop giving animals broad-spectrum cephalosporins. We need to stop giving humans broad-spectrum fluoroquinolones. We need to improve cleaning practices at healthcare institutions. And I don't know how you do it in a pig farm, but you need to improve cleaning practices in these animal production facilities. So if you go to the next slide, I thought I'd put this in for infection control. This is actually from a veterinary paper about horses and infection control. But the principles are the same for whether it's humans, horses, pigs, cattle. We need to restrict the use of antimicrobials. It probably does apply to humans. We need to minimise stress, but we need to minimise anything that changes the gut flora, and maybe that's proton pump inhibitors and H2 antagonists. We need to reduce environmental contamination. You need to isolate animals with diarrhoea. You need to use hand hygiene and gloves. And don't forget, with C. difficile, we're dealing with a spore here. And so alcoholic hand rubs will not kill the spore. So if you've got a C. difficile problem, you need to go out there and wash your hands properly in the traditional manner with soap and water. And the mechanical action of washing the hands will remove the spores. And you need to test suspect animals, be they humans or other sorts of animals. The laboratory side of things is something I don't really have time to go into at the moment, but there are moves afoot to try and improve the laboratory diagnosis, because at the moment it's lagging behind. We have a number of molecular tests which have just come onto the market, and I think the way that we'll end up all going in the future is molecular diagnostics. So if we go to the very last slide, if you think humans with diarrhea is an issue, a couple of years ago, two Asian elephants in the Denmark Zoo died of fulminant C. difficile colitis. So I think an elephant with diarrhea is something that none of us would like to look after. And on that note, I'll be quiet. And I don't know, Jane, we've got a couple of minutes left, so if anybody wants to ask questions, I'm very happy to take them.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much, Tom. So I think that's a fascinating insight. The whole animal issue, I'm not sure, has been raised in quite this way before. I mean, are the veterinary practitioners actually taking on board some of these messages, Tom?
Unfortunately, though, I think the answer is no. They're not taking them on board from the perspective of transmission of animal strains to humans, but this has become a huge animal welfare problem. If you've got, again, literally thousands, I go to these piggeries and they've got thousands of these little piglets with diarrhea. This is very soul-destroying. And they don't know how to deal with it. They're going around, rehydrating these piglets by hand. It's a huge problem. for them to deal with, and it's very distressing for the people that work there. So there's an animal health issue, and then there's the human health issue. They're trying now, I think, to get on top of the animal health issue, which of course will impact on the human health issue, but they haven't really put two and two together at this stage, unfortunately. And I hope there's no vets listening, but I do think the vets are going to be the end of us in the in the end.
Okay. Are there any questions coming in from any of the listeners live to us today?
Jane, this is Paul.
Oh, hi, Paul.
I was concerned about my hamburger and the ground beef that's making up that hamburger. Obviously, if there's Clostridium difficile spores in the burger itself, they aren't going to be destroyed by the cooking process. Is there much of a risk to that?
I've never met you personally, but I'm assuming you're normal. If you've got a normal, gastrointestinal tract, I think there's not a problem. I would certainly be making sure my meat is well cooked. If you do cook it properly, you will kill the spores. Now, if you do like a jack-in-the-box situation in the States where they try to cook everything faster than McDonald's to produce hamburgers quicker, then I think you may have a problem. It's all to do with numbers. It's to do with the human host and whether the host is susceptible. There's a whole lot of factors. I'm less concerned about that than I am about the environmental contamination that is undoubtedly occurring in places like the Netherlands. Having said that, my first case, the woman who acquired this organism in New York and came back to Perth, having spent 3 or 4 days in intensive care in Hawaii on the way home, she had in fact consumed pork ribs 3 days before she got sick. So, look, I think there's still going to be a lot more investigations on the possibility that this is being transmitted via food. So this is a watch this space situation, I think.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, it could have huge impact on Australian and New Zealand barbecues.
Absolutely.
End of an era. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Tom, once again, for your fascinating contribution to this year's Teleclass series. I think you provided an excellent insight into what's becoming an increasingly important disease in healthcare, and one that as infection control practitioners we really need to be fully up to speed with. So thank you, the audience, for listening in, and don't forget that you can access any of the other weather teleclasses by registering via the website and either listening to them live or via the broadcast or recording. The next teleclass in the South Pacific series will be broadcast live in September from the National Division of Infection Control Nurses Conference in Dunedin. So I hope that you'll be able to consider joining us for that free broadcast. Until then, thank you very much and goodbye for now.